Welcome to Gospel Tangents, the best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. Steve Shields was raised in the LDS Church and attended BYU. So why is he now a member of the Community of Christ? Steve will answer that question in just a minute, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Well, and so just a little bit more of your background. So,
yep.
you finished seminary in Tooele, and then you went on to BYU.
Yep.
And you served a mission in Korea.
Yep.
You came back, and I know you handed me your card, and you said you're a retired minister. So how did you? I know you converted to the RLDS or Community of Christ now.
Yeah.
So how did all that happen?
It's a long story. I'm a Pioneer Heritage Mormon. My great great grandfather was in the Vanguard Company, in the wagon with Brigham Young.
Oh wow!
When Brigham Young leaned up from his sick bed and said, "This is the right place." My great-great-grandpa was still delirious with the fever. Right next to him in that same wagon, Albert Perry Rockwood was his name. 2 days later, they're camped down, we think, near Pioneer Park in Salt Lake City. My grandfather, great-great-grandfather, gets out of bed and gets out of the tent and looks around and goes up to Brigham and punches him in the nose and says, "What the heck have you done to us, Brigham?" No, I don't think he... I wonder. He didn't write that in his journal, but it's like, wait a minute, we're supposed to be in California. Why are we here? that's on my mother's side of the family. He joined the church. He was baptized at Kirtland on July 25th, 1837, by Brigham Young. They were cousins.
Oh, really?
My great-great-grandfather was from Massachusetts, where his family had been since about 1630. So they were right in that first decade after the Mayflower in Massachusetts Bay Colony from England. My surname side of the family joined the church in Scotland in 1841. And then by 1850, they're on a ship out of Liverpool to New Orleans, and then steamboats up to St. Louis, and then steamboats up to what's now Kansas City. And they provisioned for the trek at Westport, and then did a diagonal across to the trail rather than going up to winter quarters.
Okay.
And they were sent out to Tooele Valley to be part of the settlement out there. My great-great-grandfather on my mother's side was in Salt Lake, and some of his family ended up in Centerville. So, Utah's my home. Mm-hmm. In many different ways. I was born in Logan, but raised in Tooele County. And my grandfather was a bishop. My father was a bishop. Albert Perry Rockwood was a general authority. He was in the First Council of the 70 under Brigham. He and Brigham were cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And the fortitude that it took to start in this barren, almost wasteland of the Great Salt Lake Valley, I admire that. I don't have that kind of gumption, And the thing about that Vanguard Company, several of the men, on August 24th of 1847, 1 month later, get on horseback and ride all the way back to winter quarters.
Wow.
My goodness, I'm proud of that.
Mm-hmm.
My grandmother's house was two blocks north of Temple Square. So as a child, Temple Square was, grandma didn't have lots of money, and it was a freebie. And they had that wonderful old museum on the southeast corner of Temple Square with the mummies and things in it. That a little kid of, 7 or 8, that was fascinating. And grandma and I could walk there because it was just two blocks. And my mother graduated from West High. My dad graduated from Tooele High. They met up in Logan at Utah State. I was born in Logan, and then they moved back to Tooele, where dad started his career teaching in Tooele County School District, which he taught at all of his career. I was really interested in church history, and I started reading these books and pamphlets that were not approved by the general authorities. And my mother warned me that if I kept reading that kind of stuff, I would lose my testimony and leave the church. She wasn't happy that she was right, I don't see it as losing my testimony. Did I leave one organization for another? Yes. But I think my faith in Christ is stronger than it has ever been. And not saying that I didn't have faith before. By going this different route, I began to focus more on what I think matters most. And history then didn't become the main focus of my faith, but became a main interest. That sort of, do I dare use the word tangent? Tangential to my faith.
We like that word.
Yeah. It was a big deal to make that move. By the time I had been on my mission and done that, I had some pretty out-of-the-box ideas about God. I met people who had strong faith in God, but they weren't Mormons, and my background told me that, well, that must be from the devil, because God only works with us. And if you're not LDS, you can't ever benefit from the Holy Spirit or things like that. I met Buddhist monks in Korea who were the epitome of what all the good teachings of Buddha are about, which are not incompatible with Christ's basic teachings. They're almost identical. And I just couldn't bring myself to say that these good people were all going to burn in hell. I considered myself a liberal Mormon. I was a charter subscriber to Sunstone magazine. I was engaged in MHA, as I mentioned earlier, in the heyday of Camelot. Leonard Arrington was a personal friend. Davis Bitten was a personal friend. You know, and they were the key movers and shakers in that Camelot era, as far as I'm concerned. And lots of the other names from that era, people that I got to know. And divergent paths, basically, I was pushing that envelope even broader. Then something happened. In 1981, there was a blessing document that Mark Hoffman somehow procured, and he double dealt the RLDS Church against the LDS Church in that deal. Now, all of that stuff aside, if the document was authentic, I saw the LDS PR machine scrambling to just make it's not valuable. Gordon B. Hinckley stood up in General Conference and metaphorically ripped the document to little bits of paper and blew them away. And I was suspicious. I said, boy, they're really scrambling hard to make nothing of this blessing of Joseph Smith III. Maybe the RLDS folks were right after all on this point. So I got to digging again. And I had quite a little shelf of RLDS books, and as I read through those, I came to the realization that my personal theology matched up really well with the RLDS perspective on many things, and so I decided to check them out. I'd been to church once or twice in Salt Lake City when I was at BYU. I'd come up and wasn't impressed, but I wasn't looking for something either. I was looking to not be impressed, so you get what you look for, I think. So I went and very tentatively began exploring over the summer. And at the same time, my marriage fell apart and I was trying to fill this empty hole. And I wasn't getting it on Sundays in my ward. In fact, I'd been attending my ward for probably close to a year every Sunday. The Elders Quorum president still didn't know who I was. And I was just one of dozens of guys in the Elders Quorum meetings. I'd met him dozens of times, shake his hand every Sunday, and I went one Sunday, and he said, oh, are you new here? And I just turned around and walked out. Uh-huh. That didn't help me. And my marriage had fallen apart. I was hurting. This guy should have known who I was after a year of shaking his hand. The home teachers come into my house, and I still wasn't known in the ward, and it was disturbing. And so that was, that was part of it. I knew then that the history the church was promoting was not the accurate history of the church, that there'd been a lot of glosses that had been done. We all do it. When we're trying to promote our cause, we promote the good things. Nothing wrong with that. That's what we do. I wanted more. And I found in the small little congregation in Salt Lake City a group of people who didn't really care where I was from or what my baggage was. They welcomed me. And I found something that was more theologically compatible with my liberal Mormonism, which I found was really only moderate RLDS. I've since swung further to the left. And in fact, one of the apostles in the Community of Christ a few years ago accused me of being in the most liberal part of the liberal 15% of the church. And he was not happy when I said, "Oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate the compliment." We're still good friends. He's definitely not as far left as I am.
And he didn't mean it as a compliment.
He did not mean it as a compliment. He was criticizing me.
Right.
I'd said something or suggested something, and he wasn't having it. But that's okay. And that's one of the things I like about Community of Christ, is that we've got this broader boundary that we function in, and we can, have that kind of a relationship with a member of the 12 and not be in fear of our membership.
Right.
And when you line up our general officers, as we call the 12 and the presidency and the bishopric, we probably have more Democrats in that group than maybe Salt Lake would have, but there are some Republicans and there are a couple of Trump supporters. And they can still sit down around the table and focus on the mission of Christ and not let that other stuff get in the way of. I think it's interesting. And and then there's room for people like me that are very liberal. There's still room for the conservatives. We have several congregations in independents, for example, who still don't have a testimony of ordaining women to the priesthood, but they're still in the fold. They haven't gone out with what we call the restorationists and become independent. They're still within the fold, and they still support most everything of what the church does. And so we've tried to make that room, for that broader perspective. It's a little challenging from a missional standpoint, from a marketing standpoint, because our stuff all focuses on the more, I don't want to say liberal, but the more progressive side of social justice, peace, those kinds of things. We're not really promoting a conservative view anymore. But that there are still people in the Community of Christ who believe in the historicity of the Book of Mormon. There's people that don't think it has any value to a life of faith at all. And yet we can still worship together on Sundays.
The Book of Mormon doesn't have any value.
There are some who believe the Book of Mormon has no value whatsoever. So that's the extreme left, I guess we could say. And the extreme right is that, there's a family in one of our congregations in Independence who I know that are rummaging around Mexico trying to find the repository. They really are, and they have lots of support, financial supporters for these archaeological expeditions. They're looking for the repository of all the Nephite records that were buried up at the very end of the Nephite civilization. That's a pretty broad. The LDS Church doesn't require the Book of Mormon as a test of faith, I don't think. Joseph Smith, yes, in your Temple Recommend interviews. And I know I have a lot of LDS friends who aren't concerned at all about the historicity of the Book of Mormon, but there's still room for them. But I think we're probably a lot broader. in allowing for a difference of opinion. When we have our world conferences, sometimes proposals from the first presidency get voted down. And we actually don't have a unanimous vote on on almost anything.
Well, that's a little different.
And that's a little different. But people voting no is not a pejorative, you know, it's nothing wrong with that. It's democracy as we view it. And that, so there's a little different dynamic that goes on in a faith community when it's like that.
So it sounds like you made the transition somewhere in the middle 80s?
1981.
It was
1981. I was baptized the end of September of 81.
Okay.
Yeah. And a few years later, I was asked to come and work for the church full time as a the equivalent in the LDS Church would be First Quorum of the 70.
Okay.
We call ours World Church appointees or field ministers, and most of us have higher level administrative responsibilities, not unlike the First Quorum of the 70.
They do have 70s now.
We have 70s. Yeah, we have 70s.
But you weren't a 70.
I was a 70 for a while, but then became was ordained a high priest, and so our quorums of the 70, there are no high priests in them. They're all 70s.
Okay.
First Quorum of the 70 in the LDS Church are all high priests with a special designation as a 70. So it's a little different.
Okay.
In fact, except for the presidents of 70, I would guess 99% of our 70s are all local minister, local priesthood members who have the missionary task, and they're not supported by the church. The what you call general authorities in the LDS Church, we don't have the broader term. We only have the general officers, which technically in the LDS Church, the 12 and the presidency are the general officers from a legal perspective. We include the bishopric in that.
The presiding bishopric.
The presiding bishopric. We call them general officers, and then we have the World Church appointees, which are full-time full-time ministers, but they have similar roles of the First Quorum of the 70 in the LDS tradition. So we're supported, it's a nominal stipend from the church. We are at the beck and call of the presidency and the 12. You know, they can send us here, send us there with different assignments, and you can't say that you're not going to take that assignment. We sometimes they offer a couple of options. We've got a couple of places where we think we could use your particular gifts and skills, this place or that place.
So let me ask you this about, because I know John Hamer was recently called to be a 70.
He's a 70, right.
And so, but he has, he works, I'm sure he gets a stipend, but he has his own job and he works.
He does not get a stipend.
Oh, he does not?
No.
So he would be more like an area authority?
He's like an area authority, yeah.
Okay.
That would be, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, our 70s are more like area authorities.
Okay.
Now, there may be some official expenses that they're provided for travel and things like that. And I don't know, every jurisdiction, every mission center of the church, and mission centers for us are like areas for the LDS organization.
I've heard they've been compared to a stake.
Well, they're... But stakes are different from LDS, have always been different from LDS stakes. It's not been uncommon for us to have 30 or 40 congregations in a stake.
Oh, wow.
And the stake presidents were full-time World Church appointees. So stake looks and feels like it might be the same in both, but it really wasn't because of the size. So I really think the mission centers replaced stakes as we tried to reduce the number of levels. So we used to have the general officers and then the fields. Each apostle had a certain geographical area. And then we had stakes and regions and districts. And so we tried to compress all of those. The stakes and regions and districts are now all mission centers, and we reconfigured that.
Okay, and there's 30 congregations in the mission
center. In the mission center, the central mission center in Independence, there's maybe 35 congregations. Mm-hmm. In the Southern California Mission Center, there's probably 50, from Santa Barbara all the way down to the Mexican border. You know, they're bigger, they're gigantic territories, mm-hmm. at that level, because we don't have the numbers, so that's different. But some mission centers may hire local staff, and typically local staff might be secretary in the office who handles all the paperwork. Most of our mission center presidents are volunteers. There's very few that are full-time supported by the church. In John Hamer's case, for example, he may be on staff with the mission center. There may be more than just official expenses. I don't know. That would be a unique local issue. Mm-hmm. If their local budget wants to support that, they can. And each mission center has their own budget. Each congregation has their own budget. And each of those jurisdictions are responsible to meet that budget and pay their bills. And they don't go to church headquarters and get any financial support, except in the unique areas overseas where we're dealing in underdeveloped countries. A lot of that support comes out of the general budget.
Okay.
So that's too technical for what you want to deal with.
Well, interesting. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Steve Shields. In our next conversation, we'll talk about Sidney Rigdon. How much impact did he have on the fledgling church led by Joseph Smith?
But eventually, the Rigdon followers outnumbered the Smith followers, 5-6 to 1.
Oh, wow.
And so I argue it really ought to be called the Smith-Rigdon movement rather than the Latter-day Saint movement, because in the beginning, the word Latter-day Saint wasn't even there.
Right.
And it was Rigdon who came up with that.
Oh, it was?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
1834, Rigdon announces that the church will now be called the Church of the Latter-day Saints.
I hope you enjoyed that short clip from our next interview. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, please go to our patreon.com/gospeltangents and subscribe for just $5 a month. If you'd like a transcript of this, please click the yellow subscribe button at gospeltangents.com, and I'll send you this and all future transcripts. Also, if you'd like a paperback like we've got here, those are available at our website at amazon.com. Just do a search for Gospel Tangents. Please get all updates at our Facebook page at facebook.com/gospeltangents. We're also on Twitter at Gospel Tangents. You can also get transcripts individually at our website, gospeltangents.com/shop. Finally, make sure that you subscribe on our Apple Podcast page. Just do a quick search for Gospel Tangents there and give us a 5-star review while you're at it. Thanks again for listening. Your support helps create more Mormon history classes and podcasts such as this, and so I really appreciate you listening. Please share with your friends. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here you'll see some more of our great videos. Thanks again.